Hi, welcome to Whiskey Cast, the cask strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 109 for September 16th, 2007. Coming up in a few minutes.
Some writer quoted some people out of early distilling and said if a bean wasn't making the whiskey in your distillery, you couldn't be making good whiskey because there were so many beans making whiskey at all the different distilleries before Prohibition.
That's Fred Noe, the latest in a long line of beams at Jim Beam. It's Kentucky Bourbon Festival week, and Fred Noe received one of the highest honors a member of the Beam clan can get. I'll give you the details later, but first, let's look at the news. As I mentioned, this is Kentucky Bourbon Festival week, and that usually leads to new bourbon announcements. Last week I mentioned plans for the Russell's Reserve Rye Whiskey from Wild Turkey, and this week Wild Turkey added to its bourbon lineup. Wild Turkey American Spirit is a 15-year-old 100-proof limited edition bourbon. It's not to be confused with the Wild Turkey Kentucky Spirit bourbon that's been on the market for some time. The American Spirit will be available in select U.S. markets this month, and in Australia and Japan starting next month. Also last week, I mentioned that Maker's Mark has a new visitor center at the distillery in Loretto, just in time for the Bourbon Festival. Master Distiller Dave Pickerel gives us a preview.
It is going to be a grand experience. It's a response to just the tremendous outpouring of visitors that we've been having. And our growth rate this year over last year is like 10-12%. Partly because of the interest in the bourbon trail, partly because we've got such wonderful fans that just have to come and see where their bourbon is made. And of necessity, we needed a mechanism to take care of that. And we believe that if you come visit Makers, your visit ought to be every bit as quality as the taste of the brand itself. And I don't want to spoil a lot of the surprises, but the old visitor center has been refurbished into the distiller's house, which it used to be. It's the furnishings and fixtures and the displays in there are of the Samuels family house in 1950s. So when you start your visit, it'll be a discovery of the creation of Maker's Mark and the Samuels family. We've even got Bill Samuels' baby book that's on display there, which I don't know that he knows that we've got that, but we do. Along with Samuels' family photo albums and a tremendous treasure trove of archival history of the Samuels family. We've replicated T.W. Sr.'s study, along with blueprints that Bill Jr. drew and Bill Sr. signed, and those are available for folks to flip through and look at. We've got their restoration manual. We've got Marge Samuels' kitchen, complete with rye and wheat bread and recipes and calligraphy examples and pewter and cognac bottles, so that we can so that people can really discover all the stories and the heritage there. And there's some big surprises that you just have to go and see to really experience.
And what's this about a weekend in Vegas coming up later this year? I've heard about it, and I know it's for the ambassadors, so if you don't want to talk about it, that's fine. But I know there's a lot of ambassadors who listen, so tell me about this weekend in Vegas, what you can.
Well, we've been, up to this point, having one national gathering of ambassadors a year, and it's always been tied around the Maker's Mark Mile in Kentucky. But what we kind of discovered is that while we get visitors from all over the place, they tend to be East U.S. predominantly, and so we decided this year that we needed a second national event. And so we're kind of taking over Caesars in Las Vegas for a few days, and we're going to have one killer ambassador party. You know, when you get past making good bourbon, the second best thing that Makers knows how to do is party. And so if you're an ambassador, you need to pay attention to your emails. And if you can get free on that first weekend of November, you need to come play with us.
If Vegas isn't quite your style and you'll be in Kentucky around the holidays, Maker's Mark holds special holiday events the first two Saturdays in December at the distillery. Elsewhere in Kentucky, a bourbon distillery is coming back to life. Angostura is buying the mothballed Charles W. Medley Distillery along the Ohio River in Owensboro. Back in June, the Caribbean rum producer bought the old Seagram's Distillery upstream in Lawrenceburg, Indiana. That distillery is 160 years old and the largest in the U.S. Angostura plans to triple its spirits business over the next 5 years and will focus on expanding bourbon sales worldwide. By the way, Angostura also owns the Scottish Leader blended Scotch brand. Now let's switch the focus to Scotland and a change in leadership at family-owned Gordon & MacPhail. After 40 years, Ian Urquhart is retiring. He spent the last 14 years as managing director. The job will now be split between Michael and David Urquhart. Isle of Arran's in the black after 11 years. This year's Scottish Distiller of the Year turned in its first profitable year thanks to overseas sales. The distillery in Lochranza will also increase production to 135,000 liters this year. Brooke Lottie is releasing the final edition of its Legacy series. The series comes from vintage whiskies produced long before the distillery was mothballed and then reopened in 2001. Officially, the sixth and final Legacy bottling is a 34-year-old single malt, but it's actually a vatting of six casks from 1965, 1970, and 1972. There will only be about 1,700 bottles available worldwide. On another note, this Monday, BBC Radio 4's Sounds of Britain show will air a feature recorded at Brooke Lottie earlier this year. The piece will also be available on the BBC website, and I've posted a link at the WhiskeyCast website. One bit of news that could affect Scotch whiskey prices. The National Farmers Union of Scotland reports distilleries are paying the highest prices for barley in 10 years. The BBC reports farmers have cut their barley acreage to a 30-year low because of demand for wheat and other crops, and poor weather this summer is also pushing prices higher. While most distilleries have long-term contracts with farmers, about 20% of the UK's barley crop is sold on the spot market. It's a busy fall on the calendar of events, and tickets are still available for Malt Advocates Whiskey Fests. Note the plural. Whiskey Fest San Francisco makes its debut this year, along with Whiskey Fest New York. Here's Malt Advocate publisher John Hansel.
We've expanded Whiskey Fest to San Francisco for the first time this fall on October 23rd, and we're very excited about that. You know, we got all the whiskeys all signed up, and we've got, you know, the hotel, everything's in place, and we're just selling tickets. So that's going to be cool. It's typical like any other event. They're just, you know, once you get past August, because August is usually like a slow time, you know, people come back from the holidays and everything. And we've got a nice we're mailing out tens of thousands of brochures to whiskey enthusiasts all over California. So I expect it to be a really good showing and a lot of fun. And the other thing I think to mention is that we're having one week after that in New York is our 10th anniversary of our Whiskey Fest New York. Hard to believe it's been that long. So we're really excited about that. We've got the biggest ballroom at the Marriott Marquis in Times Square, which is a really great ballroom. It took us 9 years to get it, and that's how hard it is to get the ballroom, but it's bigger, more spacious, and should be a lot of fun. Looking forward to it.
You'll find a link to Malt Advocate on the WhiskeyCast website, but those are just two events on what is a very crowded calendar over the next several weeks. The next two weekends will be Wild Ones in Stockholm. The Stockholm Beer and Whiskey Festival is so big that it takes two weekends. This coming weekend is also the Autumn Speyside Whiskey Festival in Dufftown. September 30th and October 1st will be Whiskey Experience Barcelona in Spain, followed by the Milano Whiskey Festival in Italy and the Whiskey Pure Festival in Aschaffenburg-Nilkheim, Germany, on October 6th and 7th. Celtic Malts holds the Independent Spirits Fest in San Francisco on October 13th. And the weekend of October 19th through the 21st will be the Wild Whiskey Weekend 2007 in Nykøbing Falster, Denmark. Finally, Whiskey Live Toronto will be on October 20th. Of course, these are just the highlights. There's a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. Let's return to Kentucky, where they're celebrating the Kentucky Bourbon Festival this weekend, as well as the first ever National Bourbon Heritage Month, as designated by the U.S. Senate. The Beam family has been making bourbon for generations. If you look at the label of a bottle of Jim Beam, you'll see the lineage going back six generations, in fact. That label hasn't changed since 1994, when Booker Nose Picture was added. Booker passed away a couple of years ago, and his son Fred has been carrying on the family tradition. That tradition is now in the corporate hands of Beam Global Spirits and Wine. It has long since passed out of family control, but the Beam heritage still has a lot of meaning for the company. This past week, a new label was unveiled with a seventh-generation Beam, Fred Noe.
I never really thought that much about it until I actually saw the picture. And with my picture beside my father's picture, I got a little bit emotional because it was tough. And it kind of got me before we actually did the unveiling. They had a little photo shoot set up on the front porch of the T. Jeremiah Beam House where they had seven rocking chairs, one for each name. And when I got down to my father's chair, there was his favorite cane and hat. So when I got to that point, I already had a baseball in my throat. I couldn't swallow. And then it was time to go out for the unveiling, so I got a little. But I mean, you know, my dad was my best friend, and I miss him a lot still. So it was a little emotional for him. But I'm tickled to death to be the next person on the bottle.
Run through the history for me. How far does it go back on the bottle?
There's seven faces on the bottle of Jim Beam. It starts with Jacob Beam. He was actually the first family member to sell a barrel of whiskey. And he did this in 1795. And then his son, David Beam, is the next picture there. And then his son is David M. Beam. And then his son is the infamous James Beauregard Beam, or known as Jim Beam. And then Jim Beam's son, T. Jeremiah, is the next picture. And then my father, Booker Noe, and now myself. And the reason the name changed from Beam to Noe is T. Jeremiah, Dad's uncle, had no children. His sister, who was my grandmother and my dad's mom, she married Frederick Booker Noe. And that's why the name went from Beam to Noe on the sixth generation.
And just to clear up any confusion, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you're cousins with the Beams over at Heaven Hill with Parker and Craig and that bunch, right?
Oh, yeah. Parker and Craig, yeah, they're cousins. And, you know, there's a lot of distillers who can trace their roots back to Jacob Beam. There was, you know, Elmo Beam, who was actually a distiller at Maker's Mark at one time. Several distillers in different distilleries in the state of Kentucky were Beams. I can remember there was an article that my dad had, and some writer quoted some people out of the early distilling and said if a Beam wasn't making the whiskey in your distillery, you couldn't be making good whiskey because there were so many Beams making whiskey at all the different distilleries before Prohibition.
I know you do a lot of traveling on behalf of Jim Beam, but what do you do on the day-to-day basis when you're not out on the road?
Oh, I oversee the production of all the small batch bourbons, and I'm down around the distillery, hanging out, sticking my nose in there, just making a little bourbon and going on the road to sell it. And it's, I think it's important. That's what Jim Beam did. That's what my father did. And that's what I'm doing. And working on some new products. And we're kind of, that's the thing. When you make bourbon, you make it today and you sell it 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years from now. So you have to be a patient person. But, you know, I go on the road because I think it's important to let people put a face behind the Beam products. You know, there really is a person who is connected to Jim Beam making the products today, and that's me.
Tell me about the small batch bourbons, because I know one of those is Booker's, named after your dad, right?
All right. My father developed a small batch collection, and Booker's bourbon, the one you mentioned, it was the first bourbon released in the collection. Booker's is uncut, unfiltered, straight from the barrel. You know, Dad did this bourbon back in 1988. He hand wrote the labels. A lady brought in a broken crock pot to the plant, and our maintenance guys fixed it. We melted wax, dipped the bottles in brown wax, and then gave them away as Christmas gifts, not knowing if the marketplace was ready for $50 bottles of high-end bourbon. And lo and behold, Dad knew what he was talking about. The distributors enjoyed it, liked it, and wanted to sell more, and it showed us there was a market for these high-end bourbons. You know, and the small batch bourbons, the reason they're small batch is Dad was never a big fan of single barrel because of the variation in flavor from barrel to barrel. So what we do is we mingle together a couple hundred of the best barrels to be more consistent every time. That's why all our high-end bourbons are small batch as opposed to a single barrel type bourbon.
One would assume that, and I know this to be wrong having tasted barrel samples before, but one would assume that a barrel of bourbon made under the same conditions from the same still, from the same mash bill, stored in the same warehouse, ought to pretty much taste just about the same. But there are, in fact, differences, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. There's big variations, and a lot of it is where the barrel is stored. I mean, by law, the bourbon cannot be higher than 125 proof when it goes in the barrel. Well, if you put that barrel high in a nine-story rack house, the proof, when you're talking about color or taste, the proof will climb to 140 during the aging because it's so hot and dry and the molecules of water can get out of that barrel. Same barrel, put it on the bottom floor of those nine-story rack houses where it stays cool and moist, the proof will drop from 125 at entry down to 110. So, I mean, you can see there's a big difference there, but, you know, you can even get more subtle changes on a barrel in the same floor. If, say, the barrel is out by the wall where the sun hits, that barrel's going to get hotter during the day when the sun hits it than the barrel that's right in by the aisle where you come into that house. So that's why Dad would always want to take barrels and mingle them together to be more consistent because he wanted that every time a person grabbed a bottle of our small batch bourbon, it tastes close to the same as we could get it. So it wasn't, as he would kind of say, a crapshoot because you can see differences in flavor from barrel to barrel, same run, same rack house, same floor and everything. But, you know, so what we'll do is we'll scatter them out, pull these barrels from different parts of the house, and you get a good composite every time.
Now, what do you pick when you're going through the warehouse?
When I start looking, the first thing I look for is the color. I like in the small batch bourbons a good deep color, especially if I'm doing the Booker's, looking for that dark, chestnut color. Then the nose, when you stick your nose into the glass, the vanilla needs to really pop, jump right out at you. When you actually taste, I like for it to have a nice finish that doesn't really burn you, but you got the flavor there. I mean, and a lot of people get scared off of the Booker's bourbon, for example, because the proof is between 124 and 128. But now we store all the Booker's on fifth and sixth floors of these nine-story houses, so they're not as hot. When you get some of this high-storage bourbon, it gets very hot on the palate. I don't like that hotness on the palate. I like for it to be smooth on the palate with a nice warm finish.
I know in the past at a lot of festivals you've done this great bourbon versus scotch debate with Richard Patterson, and one of the things I notice in just this last bit of discussion here is that he's always seeming to lose strength out of his whiskeys because of that cool, dry nature in Scotland, while yours actually build up more alcohol strength.
That's correct. And I think a lot of that is the height of his warehouses, and he doesn't have the heat in the summer. Like this summer, you know, the ambient temperature here in Kentucky was, you know, over 100 degrees several days. What that does is it makes that bourbon expand inside that barrel. When it expands, it gets it deep into that wood. And also, the heat will take that water out of the barrel because, you know, the water molecules are smaller than the alcohol molecules, and it's easier for them to get out of that barrel. It'll drive the proof up. You know, over in Scotland where Richard is, he never sees 100 degrees Fahrenheit. You know, they don't have the heat. Now, they've got the cold winters, you know, in the mild fall, but they never get that heat. So it takes them longer. You know, they're using the used barrel, the weather conditions. It takes them longer to get the color, and you don't see the proof go up that much during their aging because they just don't have that heat to drive it and make the water get out of that barrel.
Tell me about your history growing up, because I know you were pretty much learning from your dad all along as a young boy growing up, but what was it like as a young man learning the stills and learning the entire process at your father's hands?
It was interesting. I mean, my dad, it was his life. You know, I grew up with him. It's funny when I tell the stories. You know, I'm 50 years old now, and when I was a little boy, car seats were not a big deal. With, I don't know how old you are, but, you know, car seats weren't a big deal when I was a kid.
I'm of that age. I remember. Yeah, we were big, hanging around and sitting in the back window with the car.
Right, and when you were big enough to stand up in the seat, you know, that's when I started going to the theater with Dad. If he hit the brakes, he threw his arm out and grabbed me. But, you know, I was down there from that period till, you know, I got up till today. I mean, I was in and out of the distillery, and it was the place where learning from Dad, he was always teaching me stuff, even when I was young. I mean, I learned to fish, learned to hunt. But on the other hand, we're in the distillery, and he's showing me the mills where the grain is ground. We would sniff stuff, smell things. Never let me taste much. He wasn't big on let me experience it. I guess he was afraid if he let me taste that alcohol too early, I'd be banned, but I guess he knew how much he enjoyed it. But a lot of it was the smelling and the sensory, you know, what makes good liquor, what doesn't. I can remember him letting me smell some musty whiskey when I was about 8 years old, was his story, and he would mix these glasses up, and I could pick it out every time. They'd gotten some bad grain, and the whiskey was musty. This was at the White Dog, right off the still. And his story was he would watch me mix them up, and I get to smell. I could pick it out every time. So I guess he knew at that point I had a nose for this business, and he enjoyed teaching me because, you know, he wanted to pass the tradition on to me. Now I've got a 20-year-old son who, and I would hope with I think he's got a lot of interest. It'll be really nice to pass it on to him and continue this tradition that's gone on now for 7 generations and over 212 years.
Did you ever have an option to do anything but whiskey for a career?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Dad, he tried to discourage me. You know, his thing was, and I think a lot of it was to really make sure that this is what I wanted to do. Because if you're a distiller, it has to be in your heart. You know, it's not a 9-to-5 job. It's a job that you give a lot, but you get a lot of satisfaction. And it's really neat because you're making products that people enjoy around the world. And it's got to be something that you really love and you really like. I mean, he started me out night shift bottling line supervisor, the only part of the business he never worked in. And I think it was still a test to see if I really wanted a job or if I was just kind of looking for a paycheck. And once he saw that I was going to stick with it, then he kind of took me into it. And as I say, the rest is history, you know, and I'm here, and I'll be here until they put me in the ground. I mean, this is my place, my comfort zone, and where I enjoy being.
And how's your son coming along as far as his interest?
He seems to be very interested. We're actually next summer going to bring him in, let him work as an intern. Get him in the distillery because I want to make sure that, you know, that's what he wants to do. I mean, you know, the guys here at the company really want him to do it, but I want to make sure that he's going to be happy. I don't want him to make a decision that he'll regret down the road. Maybe he want to do something else. But at this point, he wants to follow. He always says in granddaddy's footsteps, you know, but I think a lot of it is me. You know how it is. You don't want to tell your father that you want to do what they did. But, He wants to come in and work in the distillery and make some bourbon. And I said, well, no problem. As soon as you get your college, same rule for him as Dad has me. You have to finish college, and then we'll put you to work. And I'm hoping he can get out quicker than I did. I had a pretty long college career. Had a lot of fun, but Dad didn't like it too much, I guess, because I was spending his money. And I kept telling him I was doing field research on this bourbon business, and he didn't want to hear that stuff. But it was... It was good. I mean, Dad didn't finish college, so I think that's why he put that out there. He went to work when he was 21, but he hadn't finished, and he never went back, never did anything else. But on me, he said, you got to finish college before we put you to work. You know, that's what I've told Freddie. I said, once you get to school. But nowadays, it's a lot different. I mean, you know, if you haven't got college degrees, you know, you're lost ball in high weeds. But Freddie, he's in college right now. He's in his second year. And I think he's going to be fine. It shouldn't be a problem.
Where's he going?
E-Town Community College, right here close by where we live in Bardstown. He went off up to the UK in Lexington. And I think the homesick and girlfriend drew him back home after one semester. And now I think after maybe next semester or next year, he's going to go back up that way, up Lexington way. Whether it's University of Kentucky or Eastern Kentucky University, he don't want to get too far away from home. I think he kind of likes it here. And I told him, yeah, you got to get out there and have some fun. That's what you got to do. Cause I said, as soon as you start going to work, the fun is not, you know, it's not like it is when you're in college and you don't have a worry in the world, you know, except your final exams or tests.
What would you tell somebody who's been drinking scotch or another whiskey all their life and really hasn't done much with bourbon? What would you tell them before they try that first glass of bourbon?
Well, the main thing is have something there to cut it. I mean, don't drink it neat the first time. You may want to put a little touch on the tip of your tongue, but when you really go to get a taste, cut it. Get it down to where it's pleasing to your palate. And however you drink the other spirit, if it would happen to be a whiskey and coke or a ginger ale or water or on the rocks, drink the bourbon the same way. Don't try to retrain your palate to enjoy something totally different in a totally different way. You know, it's, if somebody drinks, scotch, have a scotch and water with a little bit of rocks, do the bourbon the same way. Get the bourbon down to about the same strength and then enjoy the flavor. Because, you know, if you normally drink it on the rocks with water and then you drink a bourbon neat, the bourbon's going to be much hotter, a little more intense. So, I mean, you're not really comparing apples to apples. And before you go in, it's almost like if you enjoy pepper on your steak and you're going to try something, say a hamburger, but you're not going to put any pepper on it, then it's not going to taste as good because you kind of like the pepper on your, you know, food. Same way with the bourbons. Enjoy it the same way that you normally enjoy your products.
By the way, the Beams are also on what may be one of the world's largest billboards. This past week, a giant Jim Beam billboard went up on the side of the Rio Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. It's 40 stories tall. One final note, the dates for next year's Kentucky Bourbon Festival have been announced. It'll be held from September 16th through the 21st of 2008. And the organizers are strongly recommending that if you're planning to attend, book your hotel reservations now. That's because the hotel rooms in nearby Louisville will be in short supply that week. It's the same week as golf's Ryder Cup at Valhalla Golf Club in Louisville. That's all for this edition of Whiskey Cast. My email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. And, of course, I'd love to hear from you. Whiskey Cast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2007, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.